Hey guys, if you know me, you know I love to travel and you know I love to save money. This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further. Literally. They cover all things travel finance, like how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships. How to maximize points for real savings, not just free bottled water. How to avoid paying for upgrades you won't use, and so much more. They're doing great work over there. Check it out. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Siegel. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Tom McLaughlin. Before we get to Tom, here's a few announcements. Our website is traveltalespodcast.com. Find some stories that I've written, some stories that some of the guests have written. You'll find links to our social media. You'll find links to their social media. Our social media is Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. Find us there. That's always the best place. We need numbers there, so join up, subscribe. We also have a Facebook page, also at Travel Tales Podcast. You can find us there. We are on wherever you get your podcasts, so whatever streaming device you listen to us on, please, please give us a good rating. Say a few nice things even. That helps more people find the show by boosting our presence there, and if you do that, that's a cool thing for you to do. If you want to write me and maybe ask me some travel questions, or maybe you think you'd be right for the show as a guest, or maybe you know somebody who's right for the show, or maybe you just want to tell me I'm awesome. If you do, you can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. I'm recording this on July 9th on the Cunard Queen Elizabeth, a lovely ship. I've been performing here for the past week up in Alaska. And during the past week, I met a musician on board. He was a fellow guest entertainer who was performing classical guitar. And I got a chance to see a little bit of his set during the day. And he introduced himself to me in the pub. And his name was Tom McLaughlin. Very pleasant English fellow who, it turned out, had seen a lot of the world, not only on cruise ships, but traveling around on his own, and I found him to be an interesting guy to talk to. And I thought, this guy would make a good guest on the Travel Tales Podcast. So earlier today, he came to my cabin, and we passed a microphone back and forth. So at any point, if it seems like maybe I'm off mic, it's because I was moving it back and forth, because I only brought one microphone with me. But anyway, it was great to meet him, and I enjoyed our conversation. You can find his music and everything you want to know about him at tommclaughlin.com. Just make sure you spell it right, McLaughlin. But anyway, it was nice to meet him, and I hope our paths cross again one day. Here's my chat with Tom McLaughlin. Looking on your Facebook page, your wife is named Sarah?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so Sarah McLaughlin is your wife. So not the Sarah McLaughlin.
Correct, that's right. Okay. Not the Sarah McLaughlin, that's right. I mean, the interesting thing is my dad is John McLaughlin, and there's a very fine flamenco guitarist called John McLaughlin. So again, they say, is your dad the John McLaughlin? And I said, well, if by that you mean the recovery driver, then yeah, it's the John McLaughlin. But yeah.
Your build is a classical guitarist, but whenever I think classical guitarist, my brain hears and thinks flamenco guitarist, and that's not the same thing, or Spanish guitarist, but I mean, are they the same thing, or is it different?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, when people say Spanish guitar, very often they mean Spanish and classical as the same thing. So you're kind of looking at that kind of, you know, traditional classical Spanish guitar repertoire, like Rodrigo and Tarraga and that sort of stuff, Cavatina or whatever. Flamenco is something slightly different. I mean, with flamenco, it's a bit like trying to compare like ballet to tango, you know, so they're both very high discipline dances. But with the classical side of things, you're kind of looking about about that tone quality being very much at the forefront. If, you know, making a good sound is top. Whereas from flamenco, it's more about kind of aggression and kind of articulating in quite a sort of punchy way. It's less about sound quality, much in the same way that with ballet, it's maybe sort of a bit more refined, but you've got that kind of fiery punch of the tango, which I think is akin to that. Now, we have flamenco elements in our playing, but we don't really, to sort of say we play flamenco is almost disrespectful, because it's its own art, you know, and we can tip our hat to it and give it a proper go, just in the same way, really, that, you know, they can't quite pull off what we're doing. So, we respect that as well, you know.
So I should paint the scenario here. We are in my cabin on the Queen Elizabeth II, and you were performing. You did two shows and or a couple nights, and I did a night. But I have noticed in other recordings, I've done a lot of voiceovers on the sea, and I will say that the acoustics in these rooms are pretty good. I mean, do you practice in there? Because there's very little echo. It's carpeted. The walls are pretty thick and sound deadening. It's not bad, is it?
Yeah, I feel quite lucky, really, because, you know, the pianists and stuff, they very often need to try and find a lounge or a space where they can, you know, access their instrument. And, you know, very often I can just practice in my room, not really disturb anyone. I mean, it's one of those things where sometimes someone next door, I say, oh, I hope you don't mind me practicing. And they normally say something like, oh, it's nice to hear a bit of guitar coming through. And I'm never practicing at sort of unsociable hours, you know. But yeah, so it's nice that you can not disturb people. I mean, I've heard people kind of shoving socks in the sound hole and stuff to really deaden it out if they really need to kind of bring the volume down, or you know, kind of stuffing some tissue or something along the string, so you're still articulating but you're not getting the volume. So no, it's all right, you know. It's nice to have the time to practice. Sometimes I can only really think as far ahead as the next concert, so you think, okay, well, I get that one out of the way, and then okay, what's show two as such, and you think, okay, I gotta knock the rust off of a couple here, you know. But that's how it is, you know.
So if you've noticed from Tom's accent, you can tell he's from Alabama. obviously from England, and you said you were from a little town, was it southeast of London?
Yeah, southwest of London, that's right. Yeah. So I live near Petersfield in Hampshire. The little village is called South Harting. It's at the foot of the South Downs there. There's quite a well-known track that runs, I think it's from Brighton to Winchester, and you can walk that. It's in a beautiful pass. And I live down that way. I've got two daughters, 9 and 12, and my wife, Sarah. And I tend to get on the ships maybe like three times a year, something like that. So I'm maybe away about, if you add it all up, maybe 5 weeks a year, something like that. So that kind of works for me.
So just three times a year. So in terms of most of your work being on land, is it in the studio? Is it live performances? Or how do you make a living?
Yeah. It's a good one. So, I mean, my core reliable is that I teach guitar. There's a couple of schools and colleges in the south of England where I teach. And that sort of, you know, is what you would call your bread and butter, really. Maybe sort of your core reliable. And then the kind of performing side of things, it's ships. It's maybe concertos where you guest with orchestra, recitals for music clubs and things, and a bit of kind of function work as well. You might be playing in the background or something, which isn't necessarily the most rewarding work. But at the same time, it tends to sort of, you know, be reasonably well paid and that sort of stuff. So you kind of take the stuff that you really love, that's kind of the pay may be fine, and then you take stuff that you don't really love but the pay tends to be quite good, and you mash that all together and call it a career, you know.
So where is the farthest you've traveled to perform that wasn't on a cruise ship, a land-based show?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, after I graduated, there was a festival in Dundee in the north of Scotland, and I was in what was called the National Youth Guitar Ensemble, which was a sort of a little select group of a dozen fresh graduates, classical players, and we had some stuff commissioned for us, and it was really high level. It was basically like quartet music with three per part, you know. And the guys in there were incredible players, and we had some really good fun up there. They had some guests come up to Dundee. There was the Assad brothers, who are a Brazilian guitar duo, who were just phenomenal. And so I mean, in the UK I kind of get up and down quite a bit, but my sort of I do enjoy playing on the ships, because you tend to get appreciative audiences, and often quite sort of well-informed people. Someone will come over and talk to you about, oh, you know, I saw Segovia, or I saw Julian Bream and that sort of stuff, you know. And Segovia was before my time, but they've often got some pretty interesting stories. about, you know, hearing him play unamplified in the Royal Albert Hall in the 70s or something, you know, and you kind of feel like, how else do you come across those people? Do you know what I mean? It's right. Kind of cool. Yeah, yeah.
And they're still, those people are still buying physical CDs.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is generally how, you know, what I still press them, and sometimes people will sort of walk past the little stall and say, "Oh, nice CD, but I don't have a player anymore," you know. So yeah, you still got the kind of the age bracket on ships are still you know, still buying those, which is kind of nice. But also people like the physical product. I think sometimes they like you to sign something. I know we were joking last night about the guys in the Fly Rights saying that they have tote bags for sale, and right. I was like, I mean, Mike and I are behind the curve here. We need to get our tote bags.
So I believe this is, I've been to Alaska a million times, and this is your first trip, right? First thoughts, what do you think so far?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it is my first time up here. It's actually my first time on the west coast of the States. I mean, I think I've done, well, a lot of cruising, but for whatever reason, I've not got over this side before. And all I've really done is just gone for some lovely walks, you know. So in Skagway and Juneau, I just took the kind of funicular thing up and then just went around the lake in Skagway. And it was absolutely stunning. I mean, just beautiful scenery. The last cruise I did, I was out in the Caribbean and I took a little bus to the beach in British Virgin Islands. And there were two ladies on the minibus, and I just got chatting and I said, "Where are you from?" And they said, "We're from Washington State." And I said, "Oh, I'm heading up that way." And they said, "Oh, when are you going to go?" And I was like, "Oh, it's July." And they were like, "Oh, that's the best time to be up there, you know." So I was quite pleased from a kind of, you know, a local, if you like, telling me I was going to be here at the right time. So yeah, I mean, it's actually, funnily enough, it's probably warmer in the UK right now, but the weather, you know, the air up here is beautiful, and yeah, I've enjoyed the port so far.
Yeah, it is a beautiful state physically, and I remember you were talking last night, and let's just dive into the travel thing, because you were telling this story about being in Libya during the Gaddafi era, and you also went to Syria. And were these all on cruises? And how long ago was this? And tell me about that experience and how, if it was mind-altering or just weird.
Yeah, sure. It was pretty interesting. I mean, I used to work for a one-ship British company called Swan Hellenic, and they just had one 320-passenger ship. And it was kind of formed of, like, classic kind of British gentry, I guess. You know, there were lots of lords and ladies and bishops and this sort of stuff on there. I mean, I would be at dinner and sort of say, oh, Mrs. So-and-so's left her scarf behind. And they would say, "Oh, Tom, it's Lady So-and-so." Oh. You know, so this sort of thing, you had to kind of watch yourself there. But it was interesting. There was very little on board in terms of entertainment. There was like one classical artist, which was me, and some lecturers. So you were almost paying for the absence of stuff. You know, there was no casino. I think the library was kind of, you know, one of the main things you got up to on there. But, you know, to head to those places, I mean, it's interesting how countries become safe and then don't. So, I mean, Libya, I think, was 2010. Syria was 2011. You went to places like Lebanon, and then things like Egypt and Jordan, which kind of, you know, have gone in and out of being safe, if you like. I mean, the Libya thing was quite remarkable, because we went to the Roman city of Leptis Magna, and there's sort of many, you know, lecturers and people that would love to get there, and I'm not even sure what kind of state it's in now. But I was saying to you last night, you know, that in Tripoli, that there were no billboards for anything. It was just posters and posters of Gaddafi everywhere. And you know, it wasn't long after that, a friend of mine, his brother works for BP, and he was rescued by the British, the SAS, the sort of elite armed forces in Tripoli, because, you know, everything kind of went south from there, if you like. So, I mean, Syria was an interesting one, because we were due to make two port stops, and the first stop kind of went along without incident. You can see the Crac de Chevalier, Crusader Castle from this port. And then the second port, we left and they said, "Right, we're not going to the second port now, because it's no longer safe, and we're now going to detour to Cyprus, which actually isn't very far away." So, you know, this was kind of interesting. Also, we got to the southern coast of Ukraine. The Black Sea cruise was quite a solid seller back then. You know, it's a little bit different, but people would want to get along that coast, Sevastopol, Yalta, Odessa. I don't think they're up, you know, that's really happening for the foreseeable future, you know. So I felt quite lucky to be doing those. And I think that, of course, what happens, they have to plan these itineraries so far in advance. So you can't say, oh, well, we'll whack it on the itinerary and hope it's safe. You've got to know it's safe and then, you know, move forward. So, because otherwise someone will say, oh, the reason I booked it was because we were going there and now we're not. So, you know, refund, please, or whatever, you know.
I have that happen. I've had a couple ports cancel in Central America. I think it was Nicaragua. One, because there was some major protest going on and something, civil unrest, as they say. And so, I mean, yeah, you can do that on the fly. But it's weird to think, and this is something that we always talk about on the show. I always tell people, look, if you can get to some place that you've really wanted to go and you have the money and the time and the health to do it now, because you really don't know if you can see it. You know, Russia has always been on my list. You know, I'm probably not going to go there anytime soon. Odessa in the Ukraine was where my grandfather came from, you know, and then took a ship to America from there. And I always wanted to see that. Looks like that's not going to happen now. You know, for a while, Cuba opened up to Americans and then it closed again. And then you have to sneak in like I did back in the day and on. Myanmar, you know, was another one that I really wanted to get to. And there was about a 1 or 2 year window you could get in, and some friends of mine did and said it was amazing, and that closed down again. So you really don't know. Was there did you notice when you were in Libya, like the serious, like police presence? Were you always being watched? Was there soldiers everywhere?
I mean, it did feel slightly kind of straitjacketed, you know, when you were kind of there. You know, there was quite a military presence. I mean, it felt safe enough, I guess. I mean, we were kind of generally on tours and that kind of stuff, so I guess they're going to kind of insulate you from stuff slightly. But what was remarkable is that I remember thinking about the kind of guy that was talking on the tour, and he would always say, "Our Holiness Gaddafi, Our Holiness Gaddafi," and you sort of wondered, look, does he really believe in that, or is he just kind of is he brainwashed, or is he, you know, just saying what needs to be said, maybe a little bit of both or what have you. But it was interesting. I mean, you know, it's not just, I mean, I've done the Mediterranean and Norway and the Baltic and Central America, South America and all that kind of stuff. But this line was interesting because they really would go to places that weren't typical, you know, which was kind of nice. But then within that, it also included those big hitter places like, you know, you could get to the pyramids in Egypt, and also to something like Petra in Jordan. So there were these couple of highlights. I mean, I remember in one cruise, I think we saw like, you know, three wonders of the world in like a fortnight or something, yeah, which is not bad going. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
That's a big money cruise. I mean, I've been to Petra and I went there through Israel. Again, Israel, we're talking about another place if you want to see it. Eh, maybe not the best time now. But Petra was a place that I could have stayed for days and checked out. I thought it was really, really interesting. And I still haven't been to Egypt. Still haven't done that. And that and Morocco are on my two big lists. So I'm sure you've been to Morocco. Most Europeans have. You have not?
Actually not. No. I mean, no, I know.
So easy. Spain is right there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as the guy says, there's a comedy show in the UK called The Inbetweeners. And the guy Jay, who's always kind of telling the BS jokes, that he took a pedalo to Morocco. Do you know what I mean? From you know, south of Spain or something. But it's interesting because some of the music I play by Francisco Tarraga, he was kind of fascinated by North African kind of Moorish architecture and culture and that sort of stuff. So some of his works, for example, there's a piece called the Capricho Arab, the Arabic Caprice, begins with a kind of Moorish cascading vocal line. And of course, if you head in southern Spain, places like the Alcazar in Seville and the Alhambra Palace there close to Malaga, you know, those places are knockout, you know, absolutely incredible. And I think I've also been told that if you go into like Morocco, you'll get like a North African take on tapas and stuff like this. And I think that's really cool that you've got this kind of merging and meshing interweaving of kind of cultures is really cool.
So when you went to Syria, and so then you had that visa on your passport, tell me the backlash that has occurred from having that Syrian visa on your passport.
Yeah, so some of you will be aware that with an ESTA, which is the kind of the visa waiver program, a British citizen can get into the US just by filling out a fairly simple online form. But if you visited Syria for any reason within some certain dates, I think it was up until 2011 at some point, then you would be denied an ESTA. So I had to go to the US embassy and get what's called a B1, B2 visa, which is valid for 10 years. But the reason is, of course, I've been be into Sirius. You have to have an interview and this sort of stuff. And the thing is, you know, you jump through the right hoops and, you know, obviously I told the US, you know, I can't... I went to Sirius, so that's that. But every time I come into the US now, I get, you know, kind of pulled aside in customs and they kind of just check it out. And, you know, it's fine. I've done what I need to do. But it's never an overly nice feeling. Do you know what I mean? No. To sit in the little room out back whilst they tap away and what have you. And they said, the lady said in Seattle, she was very polite. She just said, you know, this will happen every time. You know, so be it, you know. But it's okay. I mean, I was there and I sometimes bring the little booklet to show, you know, this is the reason I was there. Do you know what I mean? So it's all very transparent, you know? Okay. Yeah.
So this is a common theme on this show. What was the hardest border crossing you've ever gone through? And did you ever have to pay a bribe to anyone?
That's an interesting one. I mean, actually, I remember not on a cruise, actually, but my wife and I, we did some backpacking. We went traveling around the world for 8.5 months. And the final leg was 6 weeks. We overlanded from Santiago, Chile to Rio de Janeiro. And we crossed the border quite a few times. We went from sort of Santiago into Mendoza and back and then south to the lakes and whatever. But quite often, as you would approach a border crossing, you know, we would just traveled by bus. A guy would come down the aisle of the bus with a cup and just sort of shake it, you know, and say, you know, tienes que poner el dinero dentro, you know, and basically sort of say, this is a tip, and this is to ensure that the border crossing goes smoothly. Do you know what I mean? So every time, and it wasn't, even if you just put in like, you know, 50 cents or, you know, a few Argentinian pesos, you know, you should definitely not put nothing in there. You know what I mean? So there was definitely a bit of that going on. Yeah.
Wait, so 8.5 months of, I'm assuming this is pre-children, and was this pre-marriage? Was this like the test to see, okay, if we're going to be a couple, if we can survive this, that then you'll be all right?
Yeah, pre-both, yeah. So pre-kids and pre-marriage. In fact, we got engaged 2 days before we came home. We were going to buy a little kind of flat when we were about 27 or so, and it didn't work out, and we were a bit like, oh, you know, we should do something big. We should do something, you know, kind of massive before settling down. So I basically managed to find someone to kind of look after my teaching job for 2 school terms, and the condition was that he got his experience and I got my job back. So it was this kind of mutual thing, you know. So you can buy one of these round the world plane tickets, you know, so you just pretty much just head in one continual direction. There's a limit on how many continents you can visit, but it was really great, you know. So the kind of the basic direction was we did Egypt, India, Nepal, back to India, Singapore, Bali, Australia, New Zealand, and then the Santiago to Rio kind of final leg. And it's interesting you were talking about civil unrest earlier, because, you know, really that wasn't actually the original itinerary that I just described to you. We were going to go to Thailand, and it was during when sort of, you know, rebels were literally kind of, you know, overtook over the airport and stuff. This was like September, October 2008, and it just wasn't the right time to be there. So I just said to my wife, I said, you know, I think we should ditch it. So we added some time. We added 3 weeks to New Zealand, and we added 3 weeks to South America, which actually was great, you know. And it's a shame to miss it out, but, you know, if civil unrest is happening, it's not the right time to be there, you know. And the other one, of course, is a natural occurrence, you know. So we were due to go to Fiji as well, and the day before we were due to fly out, this was back in the day of internet cafes, you know. We didn't really have the smartphone thing, so every kind of 2 weeks we would, you know, kind of get into an internet cafe and book up the next, you know, 10 days of our lives, you know, to know where we were going to be. And we got online, and there was someone had put in Fiji, and they said, oh, I've just had to take a canoe to the airport. And we were like, what? They have to take what? Yeah. Is a canoe? Because there was the flash floods and a huge thunderstorm, and it was kind of, you know, in a real state. So again, you know, the day before we had to change our plans, and we pulled the New Zealand trip forward. So, you know, what actually you think you're going to do and what you end up doing isn't always the same thing, you know. So no, it was great, and we finished in Rio, and we got engaged there, yeah, a couple of days before the end, which is really cool. And I was back in Rio 2 years ago, and it was nice to be visiting some of the spots where we were, you know, back then. Yeah.
Wow. So I assume you had taken small trips with your
then girlfriend at the time. So was there a moment in that 8.5 months where you just, I mean, tempers can flare. I mean, you get a little tired, was there a moment you said, you know what, let's call this, let's turn around. It's too hard.
I mean, we were, we had a lot of fun together. I mean, I think we cite it as one of the best things about the trip was all that time together. You know, I mean, without trying to get too soppy, we were what you would call high school or secondary school sweethearts. Yeah. We met as 15-year-olds.
Oh, wow.
And have been together ever since. So, you know, that's kind of fairly unique, I think, perhaps this day and age. And, you know, there were some challenges. I mean, there was the low point definitely was we did Annapurna base camp in Nepal, which was very, very difficult. And the views were incredible, of course. But above a certain height in the mountains, you cannot purchase. They don't accept the sale of bottled water for environmental reasons. So there's not plastic everywhere. So you have to buy or filtered water, you know, from the locals, which you assume is filtered. And I basically drank some water that wasn't adequately filtered and contracted typhoid fever. So this was pretty nasty, and it didn't really knock me for six straight away. It took about a month, but I ended up hospitalized in Bali for like 2 weeks. I went to less than 9 stone in weight through just kind of, you know, it was pretty horrendous. And you know, kind of bounced back and I was okay. But again, you kind of, we were going to do some volunteering, like working on an organic farm or something like this. And I said to my wife, look, the time that we've lost through me being unwell, now let's just ditch the volunteering bit. Yeah. So we can kind of still have as much fun, hopefully, as we were planning to before. So, but you know, we really loved all that sort of time together. And you know, things went, you know, generally pretty well. You get challenges here and there. I remember one time we crossed the border from Chile into Bariloche, Argentina, and we had no Argentinian money, and there was no, all the sort of exchange places were shut. We were like, so here we are, and we can't eat anything. So we went to the hostel, and then the hostel said, oh, you know, we actually throw in a meal with your, you know, just like a sort of simple chili con carne or whatever, with your stay. And I was like, how cool is this? Otherwise we wouldn't be eating, you know? So yeah.
Wow. So tell me about this sickness. It was typhoid? It was, oh man, that's like an old school disease. I haven't heard of that one for a while. I mean, I know people have gotten in Asia, they get a lot of dengue fever. I've talked to a lot of people who've gotten that. Malaria happens. But what are the symptoms, and when did you know you were in trouble? And what's a hospital like in Bali?
Yeah, that's some good questions. I mean, it's one of those interesting things. Of course, I had the typhoid vaccination, so it just kind of minimizes the chance that you're going to get it. It doesn't actually, you know, right, proof you against this thing. So when I was, I think their trek was like 12 days, and then maybe like 2 from the end, I just, you know, it was everything was really kind of flushing through without getting too graphic. And I was, you know, and I found that pretty tough. So we got back you know, to sort of relative civilization in Nepal, and I was kind of just drinking a lot of water and trying to flush it out, and just thought, it's just a little bug, I'm gonna be fine. And then we flew to Singapore for a few days, and I'd got some antibiotics from Nepal from like a kind of, you know, street vendor, and the guy in Singapore was looking at them like it was sort of like, you know, well, if this is really what it says it is, like, this is if to say, you know, how are you going to trust this? How are you going to trust this, you know, this stuff from Nepal? Anyway, so I went to a doctor in Singapore, and he gave me some medicine and kind of saw me through. But really, it was my immune system fighting the thing, and I was sort of winning, sort of not, but I wasn't completely flawed at this point. So then we got our next country, which was Bali, and we had this incredible accommodation, like paradise. It was beautiful, and I think I stayed there a night, and then it really gripped me, you know. So I mean, the good thing, I guess, about the hospital, it was an Australian, Western Standard Australian administered hospital. Yeah. It was the most expensive bed I've ever stayed in my life. $500 US a night before anything. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
I can say as an American, that is a bargain us. Oh, but, well, we don't have enough time to talk about our healthcare system, but $500 a night. Okay. That's fine. That's a nice hotel. Right. That's a really fancy hotel in LA, But okay, so you were there for how long? A week?
Yeah, I was in there for 2 weeks. And the thing is, I mean, I was covered by insurance. I had good insurance. So everyone get insurance. I mean, my uncle once, he stepped backwards off of a side, you would say sidewalk, right? And he broke his ankle somewhere and he didn't have insurance, you know, and I sort of thought, yeah, I'm definitely making sure this is getting covered. So yeah, it was a tough time. I mean, what I try and, you know, when I speak to my friends about the trip, they often say, oh yeah, because you got ill on that trip, didn't you? And I said, yeah, I did. But can we not talk about that bit so much? Because there was so much other great stuff going on. But, the hospital was a good standard. And, I fought on through and I was okay, really. I mean, I was talking to a guy on my table the other day about it and just talking about the kind of, you know, the wonders of modern medicine, really. Do you know what I mean? Because that sort of thing probably would have taken you out, you know, not too long ago, you know. Sure. So he was kind of talking about someone that had like 12 kids and only like four of them lived and stuff, you know, in when we were talking about being in Skagway. So yeah, you know, it's you've got to be grateful for that era that we're in, you know.
Oh my god, you forget like in life, just antibiotics alone in the last 100 years, how many people died of the flu? Millions in, you know, 100 years ago. I had a detached retina that everybody who listens knows about. That happened a couple of years ago. And I asked, you know, they shot lasers into my eye and sealed up whatever they do. I mean, and I asked the doctor, I said, what would this have happened like 50 years ago? And they said, oh, you've just been blind in that eye. And I went, oh, man. So, yeah, knock on wood, the strides we made is amazing. But so you come home from this, you know, long trip and you're already a thin guy. You must have lost. You must have looked skeletal. I mean, did your family go, what the hell happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting is that after this, when I sort of came out of the hospital, I remember just going to like a little store and just buying like donuts and milkshakes and just sort of absolutely just gorging and sort of trying to pull some of it back. I mean, the interesting thing was after I got out, we were following that up with 6 weeks in Australia, 6 weeks in New Zealand, and then 6 weeks in South America. So I didn't see my family for another, like, you know, 4 months or whatever that was. So I managed to sort of put a bit of it back on. But looking back, you know, I remember sort of being in, there's a lagoon in Cairns on the front there, and sending a photo back, and my parents was like, god, you look thin, man.
Well, Australia is a good place to get your weight back, you know, just beer and meat pies the whole time, you know. That's not bad. So you finally get home and you settle back down. Are you still around your hometown where you grew up?
Yeah, not too far away. I mean, when I was a student at the Royal College of Music in London, and my wife was in Swansea in South Wales. So, you know, we used to kind of take the train. You could go to Paddington right up to where she was. And so we kind of, you know, did the long distance relationship thing, which was, you know, it was a little tricky, but we'd had the foundations underneath us. We'd been together long enough so that worked out. Sorry, I can't remember what you originally asked now.
So you went back, did you settle down there or did you keep traveling?
Yeah, we moved back for one another, really. And, you know, I loved London. It was great to be a student there. But I also kind of loved the rural stuff, you know, being out in the sticks and the fresh air and all that sort of thing. And, you know, with my two daughters, it's a nice place to raise children. You know, we can kind of walk out the door and be on nice walks and that sort of stuff and, you know, take them out for bike rides and that sort of thing. So it's a good spot to be. But of course, I mean, the train is an hour and a couple of minutes into London. So if I want to go to I love classical music, like go to the orchestral music, piano recitals, but I also like kind of, like you say, hard rock and metal music as well. I kind of have like an alter ego. So I really love, you know, those kind of guys that, you know, super high virtuosity kind of rock guitar players. So, you know, one, you'll find me at the Philharmonia and then you'll find me at the Machine Head gigs. You know what I mean? So that's, it's someone says I'm kind of like a split personality, but I think that's kind of healthy.
No, that's great. We'll get to music later. But so if you're... it sounds ideal that you're like, you know, just that far away that you can get your taste of the city when you need it. And I assume that you probably both you and your wife still have family in the area, which helps with child rearing.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We feel quite lucky on that side of things. I mean, we are both our parents are fairly nearby, and they help out with kind of the post school pickup. Do you know what I mean? So kind of, but and they like that because they kind of feel like they're, you know, consistently seeing their grandkids. So it's not sort of like, you know, episodic, if you like. You know, I haven't seen you for 8 months. It's like, you know, they're kind of seeing them, you know, even if it's just a short time once a week. And they're very much kind of in our kids' lives as well, which is really nice. So, you know, friends of ours that kind of have parents, you know, other side of the country or the world or whatever, and they just say, well, you're really lucky to have that. Do you know what I mean? And you know, it saves some money as well, but also kind of feels like it's a mutual benefit for everyone, you know.
Sure. So just yesterday we were talking about doing a crossing, an Atlantic crossing, and I said I had never done one. Well, just this morning I was offered one on the Queen Elizabeth. So have you done that ship? And if you have, what am I in for if I take this gig?
So,
It's going from New York to Southampton.
And that's on Mary 2? Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, I've done that a couple of times, and it's I mean, they call it is the world's only ocean liner, right? I'm not really sure what you have to do for it to qualify as that, but I think it's the width of the ship, I think it's the size of it, and it's although it's only 500 passengers more than this, it's much bigger. It's much more kind of square footage per person, if you like. So it's the sort of all the kind of the lobbies and the kind of reception area and everything. It's much more spacious because, of course, the ship is spending most of its time at sea. It's not just about getting you from port to port. They say that it's extremely smooth, you know. So even if the seas are rough, you know, you look out and you're seeing these killer waves, but actually you're just coasting along, you know. So it's said to cut through that stuff better than any other, you know. I mean, for me, I do like port stops. I do like getting off, you know. I did one once. It was July of 2019, and it was beautiful weather in New York and beautiful weather in Southampton. So we just had sunshine the whole way. And this was my first transatlantic. And I remember talking to a guy out on deck, and he said, oh, yeah, I've done like 25 of these. I was like, okay, cool. And how does this one rank, you know, in terms of weather? And he goes, the best. Wow, so I was lucky. Like ka-ching, like, yeah, this, it was really cool. So and I did another one in October just the year past, and that was also really lovely. What was really beautiful about it was new I was you were autumn in New York, right? So I'd been to Central Park several times, but you know, the leaves, it was like poetic, you know, the oranges and the sort of the browning of stuff, and the leaves were falling. It was a weekend, and there were kind of runners and people getting married, and there were street entertainers doing this kind of super cool athletic stuff, and it just had a great buzz, you know. And I'd been there several times, but this had a very special feel to it. So I think for that alone, I would say I would do the autumn kind of crossing again. When's yours?
It would be last week of July, first week of August. So dead of summer. But yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about it. It's just those days at sea, man. It's what, 7 days at sea? That's a lot of looking at nothing. Yeah. That drives me nuts.
I think it's a certain type of crossing. You know, you're kind of basically doing something way slower than you have to for the sake of, you know, for the sake of dressing up and stuff, you know. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, it depends. If you're just going to get off and come straight home, you know, sometimes I defer my flight slightly, maybe like a day or something, and then get some time in New York, go to a show, try and pack that in, and you kind of feel at least you didn't just kind of get off and head back the other way. But, you know, that, you know, to be frank, that's kind of then, you know, eating into some of your fee and stuff as well. Yeah. So you got to figure that out, you know. But it's a special, I kind of felt it's a bit like one of those things, like a people say, oh, you know, oh, you've got to go to Centre Court in Wimbledon, or you've got to go to a prom at the Albert Hall or something. And some people say, you know, the traditional English person will say, oh, you got to do a transatlantic on Cunard. Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of cool as well.
Yeah, I would like to do it for the experience, do it once. And also I would try to, like, you know, maximize my travel and stay. And I'm trying to book more and more in Europe for next summer, just because, not that I don't love Alaska people. I know, don't at me or whatever it is, but I've been coming up here for 9 years and I kind of done it. So I want to do a little more Europe, which brings me to Alaska compared. You've done a Baltic, like or have you done the Norwegian fjords? I assume the fjords look like here. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's a good question. I was chatting to a lady the other day. I mean, there are certain, you know, portions of the world, you know, if you kind of if you head up north of the Arctic Circle. I mean, I did a two-weeker once which went right up to Honningsvåg, which is the most northerly point of mainland Europe there. And Yeah, this is pretty beautiful. I mean, it was again in July 2014, I think it was. And you know, the sun isn't setting up there, you know. So literally three in the morning. I was never so grateful for a cabin with no window, you know. It's like I can go in and just actually get some real darkness. It's kind of similar. I mean, I was talking also to a lady yesterday about, if you've been down to the southern tip of New Zealand, there's the Te Anau there down in the south, and you can get something called Milford Sounds, which has got that kind of low, beautiful, cloudy mist, and it's not unlike Glacier Bay. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's interesting how you kind of get to these different ends of the earth and think, yeah, I feel like I know this, you know? Yeah.
Haven't been to Milford Sound as well. Yeah, it's very similar. So I'm assuming the fjords are that, which that's a bad thing. It's amazing. I did find Iceland looked like nowhere else that I'd been. You know, I went there last year for the first time, and my girlfriend and I were calling it cold Hawaii because of the black sand beaches, the lava flow fields and stuff like that. But that was a really unique place. Have you been to Greenland? I haven't done that.
Yeah, so I've done Iceland a couple of times, and then there was a recent, maybe a couple of years ago, and it was going out of, Newcastle in the north of England, and I picked up like the second leg of this thing quite late notice, and it was kind of funny because they said, one of the ports is going to be Narsarsak in Greenland, and I was like, okay, that's cool, I've never heard of this place, but I'm sure we'll give that a go. And the guy came over the tannoy and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid we can't go to Narsarsak. The alternative port will be Narsak. So we were like, okay, whatever. I don't know either of these places, but it was actually incredibly beautiful. And we disembarked by tender, and the little tender boats were kind of going in and out of the icebergs, you know. And it was like, it was kind of mythically beautiful down there. And the little town had almost no one there. I mean, there's this great joke, isn't there, that you know, you feel like you're being lied to because Greenland's covered in ice, and then Iceland is green. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, what the hell is this, you know? But I remember going through in the little boat, and if you hit it right, the iceberg, sometimes what was underneath the water and what was above, if they were kind of equal, they would do these kind of turns. They were almost sort of like some kind of a, you know, athletic somersault or something would be happening there. So it was a pretty beautiful neck of the woods. But I think those ones, they end up being quite long voyages, you know what I mean? Because you've kind of got to get you've got to get to Iceland, and then you've got to get beyond it, if you like, which is very often why they split that in two on it from a guest entertainer point of view.
Yeah, so we were meeting the ship in Reykjavik in Iceland, and it was coming from Greenland, and bad weather delayed it by an extra almost day and a half. So yeah, it was it can be rough. And they all said that the towns in Greenland are just nothing. There's just nothing there, right?
Yeah, it kind of felt like about, you know, 17 sheds, you know, and one cafe was kind of what it was. But no, Iceland's a great one. I mean, I've been up there a couple of times, just literally in the kind of the July era, you know, so I've never really done it in the kind of wintry stuff. But I felt like it was hugely efficient. And I remember that I did like an independent tour off the ship, and I was like, oh, I wonder if they'll be on time. And they were just on the nose to the minute with everything, you know. They say that their food is all like 90% of their food is shipped in, you know, like so they can't really get like that good quality, like salads and fruit and stuff. So it's all kind of so I think as a result, it's quite an expensive way to live.
Yeah, so
I thought, I went out for one beer and it was about £9, and I was like, okay, I'll just make this one last, you know,
right,
what I mean?
Yeah, I always tell people, it's like, if you go, just bring money. Yeah. If it wasn't for credit card points, because we spent a week beforehand meeting the ship, and I cashed in a lot of credit card points on that one. That saved us. But where, if you have a dream destination that you've been wanting to see, what's on your bucket list? Where do you want to go?
That's a really good one. I mean, I was looking the other day. You probably have this. There's an app called Bean, B-E-E-N, and you can kind of tick what you've seen, and it kind of covers the map of what you've seen and this sort of stuff. And the bit that I haven't really seen of South America is that kind of northwest and west part, if you like. So things like Peru, I've never been to. Ecuador, I've never been to. Bolivia, obviously, is a little trickier. But Colombia, actually, I went to last year. But, you know, there's this little pocket of places. And, I've never been to Machu Picchu, for example, which I would really love to do. And I'm a fluent Spanish speaker. When we went to South America for the first time, I just did very basic, bus ticket and hotel or whatever. And I got a buzz out of being understood on a very basic level, and went home and did evening class classes after that for 4 years and got an A level, which is the kind of equivalent of what you get as an 18-year-old. And now I have a friend in Madrid, and we speak online and in FaceTime, and we've been doing that for about a decade. So, you know, we kind of have picked up a pretty good level. So, yeah, that part would definitely be one I'd love to see. I mean, because I never really got to the Southeast Asia part due to the civil unrest when we were backpacking, I have been to Thailand just for a day on a ship, but I feel like I'd like to go under the skin of there a little more at some point. And for whatever reason, the one that sticks out for me that I'd love to get to would be Madagascar. I think that would be pretty special, you know. My kids and I, we love to get to kind of, there's a lovely place in the UK in Wiltshire called Longleat, and it's kind of like a safari thing there. They've got giraffes, and they've got incredible wildlife, and they've got, you know, lemurs and that sort of stuff. But it'd be cool to see that in its you know, in all its glory. Yeah.
And those giant, is it baobab trees that are like the giant trunk?
Yeah, I think that would be pretty cool. I mean, again, really for that, I think maybe not a cruise. You maybe want to just kind of head there and kind of really get under the skin of a place. And I mean, it's kind of cool thing about a cruise, I guess, is that very often you get a kind of taste and you think, oh, I would love to go back there. Or actually, you know, I've seen that for the day and that's fine. You know, I mean, it's like if you go to Aqaba in Jordan, you know, Petra is incredible. I think there's also a place there called Wadi Rum, which is supposed to be cool. But then maybe, unless you were really interested in that area, I'm not sure I could say, oh yeah, you definitely want to go and spend a fortnight there. So it's quite a good way to see it, you know, whereas there are other things where you'd say, really, you know, 2 days in port, it's not enough. Do you know what I mean? So it's like there are those ports like, you know, Barcelona or Cadiz, where you can just kind of walk off the ship and you're right there and it's great, you know, straight off. But then there are others like, you know, Livorno or Civitavecchia, and they're kind of there's nothing there. You've got to get into the place, you know what I mean? So you're immediately you're on the clock, you know.
Yeah. I always tell people it's like it's a little sampler platter. It's a little teaser, and if you find some place that you're interested in, make a note and say, you know, we'll come back here, you know, and really do it right. So now there's a point you can play our UK tour guide. And where is a place in the UK that you think is, we all know London and, you know, and Liverpool and all the big spots, but where do you think is a place that's a hidden gem that people should check out if they have the time?
That's a really good one, actually. I mean, you know, my wife and I, we sometimes take our kids to North Devon, and there's some beautiful spots there coastally. It's quite a dramatic coastline, you know, so it's a big sort of big cliffs and an amazing bays where, you know, the tidal changes are huge. So there's a place there called Woolacombe, which is absolutely beautiful. And there's a little bay around the corner you can go to from there. But I would say that North Devon coastline, it's kind of, it gets tourists, of course. It gets UK interest, but it's not loaded with people. It's not like people kind of ruin it, if you like. So I would say, I mean, if you're going to kind of try and get away from, you know, once you've done your London and your Edinburgh and all that sort of stuff, I would say that would be a good spot to get down to.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the most overrated tourist attraction in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the one I would think of sometimes is you know, there's like the dungeons in London, you know, something like that. And it just feels a little bit like you're not really seeing the real thing. It's just a load of kind of plastic heads or like, you know, kind of a
wax museum.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. You know, it's this doesn't feel like something unique to here, really. You know, I'm not really seeing the authentic thing,
right,
you know.
Right,
Yeah.
So as a musician, and I always wonder about this because I travel with a carry-on and musicians and magicians and everybody hate me with my little wheel-on carry-on. You're traveling with I'm guessing, a pretty expensive guitar. Has it ever been handled like a gorilla, you know, by an airline? And have you had busted instruments and things? And is this insured? How do you travel with this expensive piece of equipment?
Yeah, it's a huge headache. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Cunard generally are pretty good. They have recently been booking a second seat for my guitar, which is great because you just kind of get on the plane and say, right, that's going there, and you know you're good. Now, for many years before that, it kind of wasn't covered, and basically it was a combination of kind of sweet talking and being polite and kind of lying a little bit as well to the, you know, the stewardess and sort of say, you know, you're taking that on board, and sometimes they'll say, yeah, that's fine. Sometimes they say, hey, oh, that exceeds the dimensions, it won't fit in the overhead lockers. And you say, well, look, it will, because I've been doing it for 20 years. But you know, just let me see if I can put it in. And generally speaking, they'll kind of just go, yeah, you know, go on first and you're kind of fine. But officially on, you know, it does exceed the dimension stated, you know. So, you know, most airlines, particularly US airlines, tend to be very good. They're like, okay, someone's got a guitar, that's cool, you just go with it. Scandinavian airlines kind of tend to be cool as well. And you get those certain ones, they just get a bit more kind of jobs worthy, if that's a word. So, you know, I was coming back from Durban, South Africa, and they said, you know, that's going to have to go in the hold, so like this. And I said, well, look, you know, can I keep it until can I gate check it, you know, which is to kind of hold it to the last moment there. And then normally when you get to the gate, what actually then you do is just kind of try and get it on board, and by then normally no one cares or whatever. So I've had to, you know, have to push pretty hard politely at every stage, you know. And normally I've had literally had a kind of captain just come out, and I think they get the final say and just say, yeah, if there's room for it. Or, you know, the stewardess will come up to me and say, oh, there's room in a little locker, you know, that we can just put it in, which is fine. But it's always a bit of a headache, you know, if you haven't got the seat reserved for it and you never quite know. Sometimes it's quite nice in the UK because you do ones without flying, so you just go out of Southampton, you know, head down to the Canaries or whatever, and back up, great, no flying, this is great, you know. But it is a headache, you know, because at the end of the day, if you get to the place and your guitar smashed up, it's, you know, there's no gig, you know what I mean. So far I've never had it damaged, you know, which is really, really fortunate. The company I used to work for, the Swan Hellenic, they, because it was quite a small operation, they would charter the entire flight, so everyone on the plane was going to the ship, you know. Very often then they would say, you know, you can have a seat for it, or, you know, we kind of own the flight, so actually, you know, you can just bring it on, and then we're going to kind of work that out, you know. I had an interesting time on one of those where we were joining a ship down in Punta Arenas in the southern tip of Chile, and it was quite a small plane. It wasn't really big enough for long haul, but we were going to fly to Recife, touch down, refuel, and then carry on. So I think it was 10 hours to Recife, touchdown, refuel, and then another 7 or 8 down to Punta Arenas. So it was pretty brutal kind of time. And we flew out of London, we got about 90 minutes over the Atlantic, and they put a tannoy thing out and said, one of the luggage doors on the bottom of the plane is kind of pinged open, and I'm sure it's fine, but we're going to turn back, and and we're currently dumping all of the fuel out into the ocean right now. And you could see all the fuel kind of spewing out like this, because of course it's landing weight, you can't land with all that in there. And that was a tense 90 minutes while we turned back to the UK. and we landed, it was fine, and they got to be better safe than sorry. But then I remember we were 18 hours late leaving for an 18-hour journey. So that was so we were taking off when we should have landed. So this was kind of brutal, you know.
Yeah, it's like when you start dumping weight, and it's like you see a guitar fly out the window. Oh no, no! Have you ever made it to the gig and the guitar didn't?
Because generally I can't tend to keep it next to me. That's always been okay. So I mean, I have you know, had the sort of the dreaded lost luggage thing before. You know, I was picking up a ship in New Orleans once, and we were transiting, I think, in Houston, Texas, and it was one of those ones, you know, where you're kind of running through the airport. We were late leaving London, and there was the little domestic from Houston to New Orleans, and it was me, jazz singer, a couple of lecturers, and we're kind of running through the airport thinking, oh, you know, how are we going to make this plane? Ha ha ha, I wonder if we'll beat our luggage. And of course, you know, there we are at the turnstile thing, you know, in New Orleans, and it's just nowhere. But that particular company, they would do a thing where they would take your luggage from the airport straight to the ship, you know. So we hung around for a bit and we were like, it's not here, you know. And they said, oh, that there's like 6 or 7 of those flights a day, you know, it'll catch up with you. So I boarded the ship and kind of just wandered around and went to my cabin, and it was there. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, it's here. This is a, you know, the odds of this actually happening. And of course, then if it doesn't happen, it's like a chasing game. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, are they going to get to me in Mexico? Are they going to get to me in Belize? When's it going to get along? You know? So I've heard these horror stories where stuff never quite catches up with you, but it's always come eventually.
How many guitars do you own? And is it like a, you know, I picture a Spinal Tap wall of, you know, all of your, wow, we don't even touch that one. Don't even look at it. How many do you have?
It's a good question. I think I have about 10. I have a couple of mid-70s electric guitars. I have a 72 Fender Strat, US Fender Strat, and I have a 76 Gibson Les Paul Deluxe. And those are kind of, you know, reasonably valuable. And I kind of, those are my kind of, really, someone says, you know, about electric guitars, you know, oh, what should I get, or how many brands are there, or what's the best thing? And after all the chaff and all the kind of chat, really there are two brands. There's a Fender and there's a Gibson. Do you know what I mean? So that's really the two you need. Then I have a handmade luthier instrument by a wonderful British maker called Michael G. And that generally doesn't come on cruises with me because there's no way I'm ever letting that leave my sight. Do you know what I mean? So for a UK land-based thing, I mean, the back and sides are Canadian cedar. The top is Brazilian rosewood. Sorry, the Brazilian rosewood back and sides and a Canadian cedar on the top. And it's a beautiful instrument. You know, it's really remarkable. And then just other kind of, you know, workhorses that I use to teach with, and basses, and kind of, you know, as I've moved up through my classical as like just a beginnery average thing, and then a kind of a student model one in the middle there, so kind of some older things as well, and like a steel string acoustic tends to be used as well. So yeah, there's a kind of a little cross section, but really if the house was on fire, it'd be wife, kids, and the Michael G would be right. Coming out first, you know what I mean?
I always wonder this because I'm a child of like the 80s and we all wanted to be, every kid wants to be in a band. And I'm sure you're a little younger than me, maybe the child of the 90s. You're there, Britpop is happening, you got Oasis and Blur and the Big Fight and all that's going on. Surely there must have been other fellow teenagers that said, we got to start a band. And Tom over there really shreds on the guitar, man. So did you ever get sucked into that band life? How did you avoid it?
That's a good one. Yeah, I mean, when I was a teenager, we had a band. We were kind of just trying to be smart, I guess. We loved kind of progressive rock. So the guys that had kind of studied, you know, kind of at music college level and had the kind of good technical level of ability.
Like
that kind of stuff. So, I mean, the guys we really loved were called Dream Theater, which is sort of like Long Island based, and all like their influences. If you go back, you know, you've got stuff like Rush and those kind of guys.
Yeah.
You know,
kind of concert, by the way. Yeah,
amazing. Yeah. I mean, they were kind of you know, tailing off by the time I was doing stuff. But you know, a great respect for those guys. So you know, we used to have a band, and we always used to just try and do like weird time signatures and play in modes and stuff, and just try and be like, you know, try and be smart. And we used to call ourselves 10p short, which was kind of fun. And our little logo was a guy that had like, you know, was holding his hand out and he was short of money. But it was a lot of fun. We used to do, you know, kind of just pubs and battle the bands and stuff like that. And then as my classical playing kind of took off and I went off to music college, you know, we kind of did less of it really. But those guys, you know, we would kind of head to rock festivals together and, you know, do the camping thing and just kind of, you know, drinking and catching bands and stuff. And that was, you know, a cool part of our childhood from maybe when we were, I don't know, 15 to 30, I guess we did that. And then, you know, you get to a certain age and you think, I'm not doing the camping thing anymore, you know, so it kind of stops. Yeah. But I was in London just the weekend before I came on the ship, and Iron Maiden were playing. Which I went to that with a guitarist friend, and they still bring it, man. You know, that was a great gig.
I hate to do the the standard DJ question, but who were your guitar influences?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the very beginning, the one that really hooked me when I was maybe 11 or something was Mark Knopfler, the guy from Dire Straits. Sure. So, you know, my dad would have that on in the car. And really, if you had to distill it down to kind of what 15 seconds, you know, may have changed your life, it's the solo, the second solo of Sultans of Swing. Oh, you know, when he's doing the little semi-quaver passages there with the pull-offs. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever, you know, as like a 10, 11-year-old. And I was just like, I want to be able to do that. And that was, you know, very often musicians have these kind of obsessive nature, you know, you kind of feel like I want to solve something. It's kind of like a puzzle and I want to know how that can be done. So I just kind of went, I was slightly late starting. I was maybe 12, but just tunnel visioned it, you know, and just caught up with all my friends that had been playing for much longer. And it was really the Dire Straits thing that kind of kicked off from there. And then I became more interested in the classical side, but at the same time refused to turn my back on what got me interested in the first place, which was the kind of rock and blues tradition thing going from there.
But I'm not surprised about the Knopfler thing, because it's a finger picking kind of style, which is kind of what you do, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, he doesn't use a plectrum, and with that direct contact with the string, you know, because it's not just a piece of plastic hitting the string, that's more kind of personal. There's a kind of an immediate touch there, and he's got a nice, a really like a, it's the, we talk about sometimes the quality of sound of our instrument, you know, and it's a bit like that comes above everything, you know, above how kind of virtuosic you are or anything like that. I mean, sometimes people say I liken it to if someone reads you a beautiful poem, like a, you know, sonnet or something, right?
But if they read it to you like this, no one would like it.
Do you know what I mean? Almost like it's the quality of sound is the top thing, you know. And I think that when you play electric guitar, people think, oh, you just kind of, you know, it's all done on the rack and the tone and the pedals and everything. Whereas with Knopfler, it's not really. Do you know what I mean? I think it is that immediate contact that he uses. And you know, people can play his stuff with a pick, but it's too articulate. It's got too much kind of edge to it, you know. So the finger thing is very cool.
Yeah. Well, we could sit here and talk music all night, but we won't, because we got to wrap this up. And getting back to travel, what do you think of all the places you've been and what you've seen? What has it taught you about people, and how has it changed you as a person and how you look at the world?
That's a pretty big one. I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, I do feel very lucky, you know, to have traveled, you know, quite a bit, either with the backpacking stuff or with the cruises as well. And I very often, what I really love doing is getting to the Spanish speaking countries, you know, because you can kind of, you know, penetrate there a little bit and kind of chat about, I don't know, anything local or whatever. And there was a time I was in Buenos Aires last year, and there was a guy, a busker with a singer. They were doing these like Carlos Gardel kind of tango songs. And I went over and said, look, you know, can I have a little go? So I played some Piazzolla in La Boca district, you know, which I've got a little video of this, and it was super cool. And he took his hat off and put it on me like this. And he was like, ah, Piazzolla, like this, you know. And so it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes you go to see a monument, or you go to see a kind of big site, you know, you're going to go and see the pyramids, or you're going to go and see the Acropolis or something. But very often what you come away with is a memory of people, you know what I mean? Of the local or this guy or whatever, you know, and that sticks out for me maybe more than a big hitter site that I saw, you know, a few days later or whatever, you know? So really it's just that idea. I mean, because I don't do this, I'm on ships, like I say, three times a year. You get some people, they're a little jaded by it. They're just like, I'm just going to stay on board, or I'm not going to do much or whatever. But for me, I do it often enough to kind of keep it going, but not so often that I'm always generally quite excited about one. Do you know what I mean? Which is, I think, quite a nice way to be. We were talking, you know, the other night about cruising really is a transient life. You know, you're kind of just here for a short amount of time, small people, and you sort of have these kind of accelerated friendships, really. And then it's kind of poof, you know, it's gone. And that's cool. But if that's all you do, that's not very healthy, man. You know what I mean? So I think it's kind of nice that you try and strike the balance there. But I think one of the things that it's made me realize sometimes on a ship is the kind of the importance of kind of looking after yourself, you know, trying to stay in reasonable shape and that sort of stuff. Because you see people, you know, in the kind of, you know, autumn of their years, if you like, and you think, right, you know, you only get, some friend of mine said, you only get, my body is the only place I get to live, right? You know, which I quite like this line. So this idea of kind of taking care of yourself and future-proofing yourself, you know, as best you can, so that you can be mobile and be that guy in the future. You know, when you see someone, you know, around deck, you know, old age is coming to all of us, but, you know, you can look and say, I don't want to be that guy. I want to be that guy. You know what I mean? And I think sometimes coming on ships and being surrounded by, you know, a lot of old people, that's one thing I think I'd say I've taken from it is to try and take care of yourself and become that guy.
There you go. Well, I appreciate you doing this. It's been a pleasure, and it's been fun meeting you. And then so hopefully we'll meet each other again somewhere around the world. Who knows? And this is where you can get in your plugs. Where can people find you online? And if they want to buy a CD or whatever, give us all your sites and whatever.
Yeah, cool, Mike. So my website is tommclaughlan.com, and you have to spell McLaughlin, McLaughlan. I do have an Instagram page. It's not particularly active, to be honest. I'm of that generation that probably doesn't use it as much as I should, but it's at TMC Guitars, which you can find me there. And yeah, you know, you can see what I'm up to on my webpage. And it's been a great pleasure, Mike, to have a chat with you about things. I mean, I sort of said, you know, do I need to prep? I mean, what's the kind of angle here? He's like, just rock up. You know, we were chatting in the pub last night, so you don't need to prep any more than that. We're just going to roll with it. So it's been a lot of fun. But thanks for your time, man.
It's been great. Tom McLaughlin, everybody. For spontaneous travelers, Winging It is the perfect listen. James Hammond shares stories and tips from 75-plus countries. Find it at voyescape.com.